Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholars Series, where great professors teach you. My name is Paul Hecht, and I'll be your host. Today we begin a course entitled Cold War on the Brink of Apocalypse. Your professor is David S. Painter of Georgetown University. Professor Painter is an associate professor of history in the Department of History and Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Professor Painter's areas of expertise include diplomacy and international economic relations. He received a B.A. in History at King College, a B.A. at Oxford University in Modern History and Modern Languages, and his Ph.D. in United States History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Professor Painter's research focuses on the political economy of United States foreign relations, especially as it relates to the international oil industry. He is currently engaged in a number of projects, including a study of the 1951 through 1954 Iranian oil crisis, and the environmental impact of the United States military with J.R. McNeil. Professor Painter recently completed revisions for a new edition of Origins of the Cold War, an international history co-edited with Melvin P. Leffler. The devastating U.S. atomic bombing of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki simultaneously brought World War II to an end and gave birth to the Cold War. The post-war world would thereafter be marked by the fragile relationship of two superpowers with opposing ideologies, the United States and the Soviet Union. For 45 years, these two superpowers would vie for supremacy in world politics, with the United States determined to promote democracy and the Soviet Union committed to the spread of communism. The Cold War, defined by events such as the Cuban Missile Crisis, turmoil in the Third World and the arms race, held the potential for an apocalyptic confrontation that could have spelled doom for the human race. Understanding the Cold War, with all of its far-reaching global implications, is essential to our understanding of the history of the second half of the 20th century and beyond. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites, a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students, and yes, of course, a final exam. And now we begin Cold War on the Brink of Apocalypse. Lecture 1, Hiroshima and the Origins of the Cold War. And now, Professor Painter.
The Cold War was at the center of world politics for 45 years. It dominated the foreign policy of the United States and the Soviet Union. It deeply affected their political, their economic, and their military institutions. It shaped domestic and foreign policies of nations all over the world. Hardly any part of the world escaped the impact of the Cold War. Today, I'm going to begin, however, with the event that set the stage for the post-war world, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the atomic bombs that we used in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945. These were key events in the history of the post-war world. For one thing, over 200,000 people lost their lives in these bombings, the two bombings together. And that raises a very important moral issue. Was use of the bomb necessary? That's a very controversial issue. It came up in 1995 when the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. decided to do an exhibit about the 50th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the people who wrote the script for this exhibit, they raised a lot of controversy. And what's interesting is their script pretty much followed what most scholars now believe about the use of the bomb, and it revealed that there's a great deal of public professional divergence over what people know and what they think about the use of the atomic bomb in 1945. It's a very important issue. It came at the intersection of World War II and the Cold War. World War II was coming to an end. The Cold War was about to begin. So studying and understanding the use of the atomic bomb, especially the first bomb at Hiroshima, lets you know a lot about the diplomacy of World War II, as well as about the origins of the Cold War. It also tells you a lot about U.S.-British relations. Most people forget that the development of the atomic bomb during World War II was a joint Anglo-American endeavor, that the British and the Americans worked together. And it gives you a little bit different angle when you look at this side, as well as the looking at the atomic bomb as an issue in U.S.-Japanese relations, which it is as the last battle of World War II, it's an issue in U.S.-Japanese relations. However, as the first battle or the first shot of the Cold War, it also raises an issue of U.S.-Soviet relations. And so to understand this, it's important to ask the right questions. Why was the bomb used? What was the bomb as an alternative, seen as an alternative to? It's important to look at the whole time period, not to begin in the summer of 1945, but to begin during World War II with Franklin Roosevelt, not with Harry Truman, and see the decisions that Roosevelt made and how those decisions affected the decisions that Truman would later make. Truman became president in April 1945. He did not even know about the atomic bomb until he became president. He was briefed after he became president. So it's very important to ask the right questions, to start early during the war, to look at the context, and the very important context is this intersection of World War II and the Cold War, and then to look at the options that Truman faced when he made the decision about the bomb. So let's begin first, chronologically, with Franklin Roosevelt's legacy. That's very important to look at when the bomb, when the United States and Britain decided to develop atomic weapons. It was during World War II, and what they were most worried about was that Hitler, that the Nazis would develop an atomic bomb. The scientific paper that really spurred interest in the atomic bomb was written by German scientists. German science was at the forefront of physics at this time, so people were very concerned that the Nazis would develop an atomic bomb, and there was no doubt if they had one, they would use it. So first, there was a great push to develop a bomb. Second, people saw the atomic bomb from the beginning as a legitimate weapon of war. You have to remember, there had not been atomic bombs. Most people were not nuclear physicists. There were only a few nuclear physicists at this point, and most people only understood maybe it's just a bigger, better bomb. So they saw it as a legitimate weapon and a weapon that would be used when it was ready. And at first, it was assumed it would be used against Germany. It was not ready. Germany surrendered in May 1945. Work continued, however, on the bomb, even though there was not a great deal of concern about the Japanese developing the bomb. So first, the atomic bomb was seen as a legitimate weapon. It would be used when it was ready. Secondly, already in World War II, there was a blurring of the distinction between civilian and military targets. All sides in World War II engaged in what was known as area bombing of cities. Bombing in World War II was not that accurate. You could not hit a specific factory. You could hit a specific area. The Americans, at least, had bomb sites. We could hit a specific area of a city. Most bombing raids hit cities because they were big targets. Most bombs did not fall within a mile or so of their target, some even greater. Okay, the distinction between civilian and military targets, a distinction that's very important in moral terms, this distinction had been erased. The United States, Britain, Germany, we were already bombing combined civilian and military targets. We were bombing cities. So that's another important aspect of Roosevelt's legacy. A third important aspect is that Roosevelt and Churchill decided there would be no international control of atomic energy and no sharing of information with other countries. The U.S. and Britain shared information about the atomic bomb, but they did not share information with their key ally, the Soviet Union. As one historian has written, there were going to be four policemen in the post-war world. Only two of them would have the bomb. The four policemen was an idea that Roosevelt had, that the United States, Great Britain, Soviet Union, and China would share policing duties, share control of the post-war world. Roosevelt believed four policemen, there would be four policemen. Only two of them would have the bomb. And this lack of sharing with the Soviet Union is very different from some popular views of Roosevelt as being naive about the Soviets. The most important military weapon of the war, he kept this away from the Soviets. And the reason he did this, and this is another part of his legacy, there was an assumption that Roosevelt shared with Churchill that possession of the atomic bomb would confer diplomatic advantages. Possession of the atomic bomb by the United States and Britain would help them compensate for the geopolitical position of the Soviet Union, the large Red Army, and the fact that the Soviet armies were in the heart of Europe. Churchill once said, look to the atomic bomb as a technical fix for British weakness, that without the atomic bomb, nothing stood between the white snows of Russia and the white cliffs of Dover. And he felt having the atomic bomb would make up for this great disadvantage that Britain faced. The final assumption from Roosevelt was that the U.S. was going to fight World War II with a strategy that minimized U.S. casualties. The United States continually tried to keep the casualty rate down, and we used air power to do this mainly, air and sea power, but using the atomic bomb would keep U.S. casualties down. So Roosevelt's legacy, the bomb was a legitimate weapon. There was not very much of a distinction between civilian and military targets. That the United States would not share information about the bomb with anyone except the British. He assumed, and this was part of the legacy, that possession of the bomb conferred diplomatic advantages on the people who had the bomb, and he wanted to minimize U.S. casualties. So very important parts of the legacy. Truman could not go beyond these. Another very important thing to consider is the context. As I said at the beginning, the bombing at Hiroshima came at the intersection of World War II and the Cold War. When the bomb was being developed and all the years of work on the bomb was coming to fruition in the spring and early summer of 1945, you had four things going on at the same time. The war in Europe had ended in May 1945, and one of the things that held the Grand Alliance together was the opposition to Germany, the Grand Alliance, the United States, and Great Britain and the Soviet Union fighting Germany. Well, with the end of the war in Germany, one aspect of their common cause was gone. And the second thing that was going on in the spring and early summer of 1945, the war against Japan in the Pacific was coming to a climax. One of the bloodiest battles in the war, the Battle of Okinawa, was occurring at the same time that the bomb was being prepared. So it brought to people's attention how bloody the war in the Pacific could be, and actually made the bomb seem much more desirable. The bomb could end the war and save lives, save American lives at least. At the same time, the war in Europe had ended. The war in the Pacific was coming to a climax. We began to have problems with the Soviets about the way they were setting up a sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. So again, this gets people to think about how important it will be to have the bomb, the diplomatic advantages the bomb might confer. And then the bomb is coming to nearing completion. They're getting ready to test one of the two models of the bomb that they were building. And this, of course, makes people have to make decisions. Now, the traditional view of why the bomb was used, and this view grew out of Harry Truman's memoirs and especially out of a 1947 article in the influential journal Foreign Affairs by Henry Stimson, who was Secretary of War. They wrote that the decision to use the bomb was purely a military decision. It was a decision to end the war quickly and to save lives. It was an alternative to a costly invasion of Japan, and the Japanese were not ready to surrender. Therefore, the bomb had to be used. It's a very persuasive article. It's very well written and makes a very clear case that the use of the bomb was a military decision to end the war quickly and to save lives. However, as is often the case in history, new documents, contemporary documents, minutes of discussion, memoranda from the time have now come to light, and people are beginning to question, was it that clear cut? For one thing, historians now look at this wartime policy on sharing information, and they say, Well, if this was a military decision, why are, you know, and there's no political calculation, why are we so concerned not to share information from the Soviets, with the Soviets? They knew the Soviets were spying. They weren't. They did not catch the spies until later, but they knew there was some spying going on, but they did not share information. Secondly, historians said, you know, they found out that the Potsdam Conference, which occurred in July 1945, Truman had that conference postponed until the first bomb was tested. He wanted to know if the bomb worked before he went into the conference. And people say again, why did he want to know this if there were not political calculations involved? Certainly, people ask, why was the bomb used in August 1945 before the Soviets entered the war? At Yalta Conference in February 1945, the United States had gotten the Soviets to agree to enter the war against Japan 3 months after the end of the war with Germany, and we felt having another front, the Japanese having to face another front, the large Japanese army in China and especially in Manchuria, having to face the Soviets, this would put additional pressure on the Japanese. It would save American lives, bring the war to end. Why did we use the bomb in August before the Russians entered, before seeing why what would happen if the Russians entered the war? And thirdly, historians look at this and say, now, wait a second. We used the bomb in August 1945, but the invasion of Japan, that the bomb is an alternative to, was not scheduled to begin until November 1945. And that was only of the southernmost island. And the main invasion of Japan was not scheduled to begin until early 1946. Why did we, historians say, why did we rush to use the bomb? One other thing has come to light even more recently is contemporary planning documents that estimate the casualties of an invasion of Japan are very low. Now, that's a relative term, very low. They say 40 to 50,000 people killed. In his memoirs, Truman talks about 500,000. Sometimes people use figures of casualties of a million. And some historians have been suspicious and say, well, they inflated these figures to justify a decision. I would say, given the strategy of minimizing casualties, nobody wants casualties of 40,000 or 50,000. However, some people look at this and say, why are they inflating these figures? What are they trying to hide? On the other hand, recent evidence about Japanese policy and diplomacy confirm the earlier argument that the Japanese were not ready to surrender in the summer of 1945. It's very clear that the Japanese government knew Japan was defeated. They were going to lose the war. However, they were not ready to surrender. And in fact, their strategy was to put up as stiff as a resistance as possible in the hopes that then they could get a negotiated solution to the war, preserve as much of their empire as possible, and definitely preserve the position of the emperor as the head of the Japanese state. So this particular evidence on the Japanese side supports the traditional view that the bomb was used because the Japanese were not ready to surrender. And here's where it's important to ask the right question. Many people who criticize the use of the bomb think that Truman should have been looking to alternatives to the bomb. In other words, they think use of the bomb is something new, it's something morally wrong, many people see, certainly cost a lot of lives. What were the alternatives to using the bomb? That's not what Truman and people at the time were thinking. They were looking for alternatives to an invasion of Japan. You have to look at these things in historical context. They're looking to an alternative to the invasion. Now, what were the alternatives to the invasion? Well, they could have continued what they were doing. And what were they doing? They were bombing Japan regularly on a daily basis. They were firebombing cities, killing a lot of people. They were blockading the Japanese coast. This was very effective. And after the war, the U.S. bombing survey said, we could have continued this. The war would probably have ended before November 1945, the first invasion, or surely before January 1945, the main invasion. However, one has to ask, does this save lives? Continuing bombing and blockade doesn't really save many lives. It doesn't kill 200,000 people in just two bombings, but it kills a lot of people. There's also opportunity cost. If we continue the bombing and blockade, we're tying up our military forces with the war with Japan at the same time that we're having problems with the Soviets. We're tying up resources in the Pacific when we may need them in Europe, and it could undercut, the longer the war continues, it could undercut public support for the war in the United States, and it also gives the Japanese a certain amount of encouragement that their strategy of making the war costly and drawn out is working. So continuing bombing and blockade would have worked as an alternative to using the bomb. It doesn't really address the problem of saving U.S. lives, of minimizing casualties. Another alternative people point to is, why didn't we wait for the Soviets to enter the war? And historians now argue that the shock of the Soviets entering the war, in combination with the bombing of Hiroshima, is what makes the Japanese government finally decide to surrender. The problem, of course, for waiting for the Soviets to enter the war is that the Soviets will enter the war and they will make gains. They will take over territory. Soviet troops entered Manchuria. Soviet troops entered Northern Korea. And the fear is, waiting for the Soviets to enter the war, the Soviets will participate and they will want some reward for their participation. Another alternative to invasion was modifying our demand for unconditional surrender. The United States demanded that the Japanese surrender unconditionally, and the Japanese government was very concerned about the position of the emperor. They did not want anything to happen to the emperor. Their slogan in the United States was "Hang the Emperor." People in the United States were very angry about the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. They were very angry about the way U.S. prisoners of war were treated. They were very angry in general about the way the Japanese conducted the war. The Japanese government, and of course the emperor, they were all very concerned about what would happen. And so they did not want to surrender unconditionally. They wanted to negotiate a negotiated surrender. And U.S. specialists on Japan said, if we assure the Japanese that we will preserve the imperial institution, as it was known, that the Japanese would be much readier to surrender. However, people said, if we give in, if we back away from this demand, this will increase Japanese morale. They'll think, well, if we just fight a little harder, maybe they'll make more concessions. It would also undermine public support for the war. We were fighting a war to end Japanese aggression, to end the Japanese empire, and all of a sudden we're backing off. People would say, what's it worth? Why don't we just get out, negotiate, and leave this alone? So modifying the demand for unconditional surrender, yes, it might make the Japanese readier to surrender. However, it might make the Japanese want to hold out for more concessions. Another option, we could have done a non-combat demonstration of the bomb. In other words, we could have gathered diplomats from around the world, Japanese representatives, taken them to a remote island, and detonated a bomb and let them see how powerful it was. Well, there's some problems with that. One problem would be, would it work? What if you took all these people there and it was a dud? It didn't work. They've only tried once, so they're not sure whether it would work. And it's one of the scientists said, well, he had a solution for that. If it didn't work, just kill all the people who were there and then say it worked so well it killed everyone. And then he said, wait a second, I'm doing this as a way to save lives, and I just said kill all the representatives. So that one wasn't very good. The other problem, of course, with doing it on a deserted island was you really couldn't tell how powerful it was. It's not blowing anything up. Now, of course, the bomb had been tested. At least there were two bombs. There was a uranium bomb known as Little Boy, and there was a bomb based on plutonium known as Fat Man. The scientists were so convinced that the uranium bomb would work, they didn't even test it. The actual test of the uranium bomb of Little Boy was the attack on Hiroshima. That was the actual test. However, they weren't as convinced that the plutonium bomb would work, and they also felt that it would be good to at least test something. I think it would settle the nerves of the politicians. So they did test the plutonium bomb. It was in Los Alamos, New Mexico. They tested it in the desert, actually while the Potsdam Conference was going on. And they were the scientists knew this would work, but scientists being scientists, there were reports that the scientists actually bet on whether the bomb would work. There were actually three bets. One, will the bomb work or it won't work? The second bet was the bomb will work and it will blow up all of New Mexico. Now, obviously, the scientists who are on site in New Mexico won't be around to collect for that one. And the third bet was, well, maybe we don't know that this would happen. It's theoretically possible. Maybe it will ignite the atmosphere and destroy the Earth. In this case, nobody collects. However, this was more and done in fun. The scientists were sure it would work. They did not need to see it destroy buildings and structures to know how powerful it was. Now, when this was reported to Truman at the Potsdam Conference, Churchill later found out about it, and he says, you know, he knew something really pepped Truman up, but Truman seemed to be much more excited and much firmer in his negotiations with the Soviets at the conference once he knew how that the bomb worked well. And also, he had a conversation with Stalin. He didn't say, we've tested an atomic bomb. He said, we've developed a new weapon, and I think we're going to use it. And Stalin said, well, I hope you do use it, and that's it. Truman thought Stalin did not understand what he was talking about. And in fact, we now know from Soviet memoirs and other Soviet documents that Stalin knew exactly what Truman was talking about and went back to his advisors and said, we need to speed up the work. I think his words, we need to talk to Kurchatov, who was the scientist in charge of this program, and tell him to get busy. And one of the ironies, I call it an irony of the scientific method, the United States during the war had spared certain Japanese cities from conventional bombing so that when we did use an atomic bomb, we could see how powerful it was. It would make, you know, if you bombed a city that was already leveled, you really couldn't see the power of the bomb. So Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and other cities were spared from bombing so that when they were, if it came to it, when they were attacked with atomic bombs, we could see how powerful they were. A non-combat demonstration on a deserted island. People said, well, you know, it made a lot of noise. We saw a lot of heat, but I didn't see much destroyed. I don't really know what, you know, is this that important? So that leaves you with the final alternative to invasion is use the atomic bomb. And the atomic bomb has more advantages than disadvantages. It gets the war over, has the potential to get the war over quickly. Getting the war over quickly saves American lives. It saves the lives of the soldiers, not only the soldiers and sailors who would die in an invasion of Japan, which was fairly was in the future, but people who were dying every day during the war. People die all the time during wartime. They fall off ships. They die of disease. There's small battles going on all the time. So using the atomic bomb would end the war quickly. That would free up U.S. resources. It would end the war before the Soviets played a major role in the Pacific. If the Soviets don't play a major role in the defeat of Japan, the Soviets have no claim for occupation rights in Japan. They have lesser claims for gains in Asia. And also, it seems to be a way to get things done. It justifies the money that we've spent building the bomb. It justifies some people's feeling that the Japanese deserve this, the attack as revenge or as retribution for Pearl Harbor. So using the atomic bomb, if you see it as an alternative to invasion, in other words, you ask the right question. You don't say, what were the alternatives to using the atomic bomb? You ask the question, what were the alternatives to an invasion of Japan? The atomic bomb, as compared to other alternatives, seems to have more advantages than disadvantages. Now, what I've tried to lay out today is what I see as a new consensus, at least among scholars who have studied this, of why the atomic bomb was used against Japan. And as I said, the first reason, there was a lack of incentives not to use the bomb. Using the bomb had more advantages and disadvantages. And it's interesting, there really was not a decision to use the bomb. The momentum, the assumption from the beginning that the atomic bomb was a legitimate weapon that would be used when it was ready, this assumption created a certain momentum that when the bomb was ready, it would be used. And Truman never gave a specific order, use the atomic bomb against Hiroshima. He just authorized the military to use the bomb when it was ready, and the military did what they were told to do. They bombed Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, and then on August 9th, they dropped a second atomic bomb on Nagasaki. And they were preparing to drop a third atomic bomb when the war ended. So there was really no decision to use the bomb. There was no decision not to use the bomb. And that's what it would have taken not to use the bomb. And the reasons, all the advantages for using the bomb kept people from making that other decision. As I say, the advantage is the bomb. It ends the war quickly with low U.S. casualties. It has the diplomatic advantage of ending the war quickly. It limits potential Soviet gains. Using the bomb satisfies some people's desire for revenge, revenge for Pearl Harbor, revenge for the treatment of U.S. prisoners of war, revenge for such Japanese atrocities as the rape of Nanking and the war against China. And even, and it seems relatively trivial now, but some people said we needed to use the bomb to justify the effort and the expense of developing it. They were afraid that all this money poured into the Manhattan Project, the name of the project to develop the bomb during World War II, all this money, if they didn't produce something for it and use it, they would be criticized for that. Now, the costs were tremendous. Over 200,000 people lost their lives. Most of these people were civilians. So 200,000 people, at least, mostly civilians, lost their lives. It also had a big impact on the Soviets. The Soviets thought the United States is sending us a signal. And right after, Stalin found out about the bomb, he called in his scientists and said, we need to step up our work on the project. So this made the Soviets want to accelerate their own project of building an atomic bomb. And another impact on the Soviet Union and on the outbreak of the Cold War, it makes it much more important for the Soviets to control territory around their borders so that if the United States does decide to bomb them, to use atomic bombs against them, it will have to fly over a lot of hostile territory before it reaches Soviet soil. So it makes this buffer zone that the Soviets want around their territory, and especially in Eastern Europe, more important than it otherwise would have been. So in this case, the use of the atomic bomb not only takes many lives, it also has an impact on the development of the Cold War. Now, some people argue, yes, this is all true, but there were benefits from using the bomb, benefits compared to the other alternatives. They argue that actually use of the bomb saved some lives. Obviously, it didn't save the lives of the people who died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It certainly saved lives of people who would have been involved in an invasion of Japan, and it saved Japanese soldiers and civilians' lives as well as the lives of American soldiers. However, I don't think Harry Truman was calculating the impact so much on the Japanese as on the United States. But it did save some lives, and one of the groups that who benefited from this, I had a student once whose grandparents were Dutch. They lived in Indonesia, and they were in an internment camp, and they were about a month from starving to death when the war ended. If the war had gone on another month, they would have died. So you have all these people in these occupied areas in Southeast Asia and in China. You have civilians starving to death in Japan. If the war had continued longer, they would have lost their lives. It's very difficult to balance, to calculate, to estimate those deaths, those possible deaths, against the actual deaths that occurred at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And finally, if you can get one good thing out of using the bomb, is that it was not used again. We used a bomb at Hiroshima, we used a second bomb at Nagasaki, but the atomic bomb has never again been used in warfare. In fact, when Harry Truman got the first reports about the damage and the deaths caused by the bombing of Hiroshima, he gave out an order, and he ordered that no further bombs be used without his express authorization. And this is the first decision not to use the bomb. When he learned this, Nagasaki had already been bombed. He had not gotten the report on that. The Japanese surrendered on September 15th 1945, and the bomb was never again used in combat. That is perhaps the main advantage one can gain, can draw from the use of the atomic bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, the use of the atomic bombs against Hiroshima and Nagasaki, yes, they ended World War II, and they were an important episode in U.S.-Japanese relations, but they also laid an important part of the groundwork for the Cold War. Now, the Soviet Union was also trying to develop a bomb during the war, but as I said earlier, the United States did not share information with the Soviets. The United States and Britain worked together. They did not share information with the Soviets. The Soviets, however, there was a very strong physics community in the Soviet Union, and the Soviets had an atomic bomb program. They did not devote many resources to the program during World War II because they knew it would take time and they had other more pressing concerns. They were fighting the war against the German invaders, and some of the people on the project were put in moved from the project to deal with more pressing issues that were devoted to the war. If you spend a lot of money on the bomb and the Germans invade and take over your facility, you've just wasted your money. So the Soviets were building one, but the U.S., knowing that the U.S. was building a bomb through spies, knowing that a bomb was possible, this created suspicions. One of the Soviet scientists who had been drafted into the army was on leave during the early part of the war, and he decided to look in physics journals to see what was going on in his field. And he noticed that after 1942, there were no articles about possible military use of atomic energy in the journals, and he concluded that this has become a classified issue. And he concluded that the Americans were working on the bomb. He wrote Stalin a letter. Stalin actually got the letter, read the letter, and said, "Why have not my spies been telling me this? Why do I learn from a lieutenant out in the field about this going on?" So the Soviets knew this was going on. They knew we were keeping it from them. They knew, or they believed, that possession of a bomb would give the holder of the bomb diplomatic advantages. They wanted to have one, too. When Stalin told his people to work on the bomb, he said, "Build us a bomb. It will restore the balance." And as an indication of how seriously Stalin took this, he put his secret police in charge of the program. Now, when the secret police are in charge and you don't meet your contract, you don't lose your contract, other bad things happen to you. So this was how seriously the Soviets were taking the bomb. It restores the balance. The Soviets felt that if they made concessions, one of the things the Americans thought was, if we have the bomb, we can force the Soviets to make concessions. It actually made Stalin decide not to make any concessions, even on small issues. He was afraid if he appeared intimidated that the Americans would continue to press him, that they would begin to bully him. So he decided how we will react to the fact that the Americans have the bomb, we will pretend that it doesn't matter. And in fact, in one of the conferences right after the war, Molotov, the Soviet foreign minister, joked that the American Secretary of State was negotiating with a bomb in his hip pocket. And he was doing this, he was trying to make light of the bomb, trying to say it didn't make a difference because the Soviets did not have one, and we did. They felt that gave us advantages, and they could not back down, that if they backed down, we would use it against them. The other thing, the other big impact it had, it made the Soviets even more concerned to have a buffer zone around their borders to control all these areas so that when the American bombers came, if they did come, they would have to fly over hostile territory before they reached the Soviet Union. And this would give Soviet air defenses a chance to intercept and destroy the bombers before they reached there. So the use of the atomic bomb was a very important event, not only an event ending World War II, but an event that encapsulates many of the suspicions that led to the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. Now, this is only a part of the beginning of the Cold War. This is the transition event. This is the hinge event between World War II and the Cold War. And in the next lecture, we'll move to the world in 1945 and look not only at the atomic bomb, but a wide array of factors and see how the changes that World War II brought to the international system interacted to produce Soviet-American conflict, to produce the Cold War.
This ends Lecture 1.